All right, folks, we are back on the T-Talk podcast brought to you by Flagstick.com. We're trying something different. I'm looking at Scott through a webcam right now. This is exciting. You look great through a webcam. Who's to say the camera adds 10 pounds?
It's probably a safer way to see me right now.
Yeah, no, the world hasn't gotten better since the last time we chatted, unfortunately. More cancellations. It all makes sense. You know, we're going to get there eventually, but obviously I think the biggest one we should get off the top is the Olympics. The Olympics was officially canceled this week. By canceled, I mean postponed till a year from now.
Yep.
Shout out to Canada, though, for getting ahead of the curve and basically pulling their athletes out prior to that. What were your thoughts when you first read that?
Well, I think it was a wise decision. I mean, Canada's been always involved. Obviously, there was an interview with Dick Pound, who's an IOC member from Canada, a longtime IOC member. And
great handle, too.
And obviously those jokes always come up. But, you know, the Canadian Olympic Committee and the Canadian Paralympic Committee got ahead of it. Made that decision. And you know, in talking to some of the, not just the athletes as well, but coaches, some other people that were supposed to be part of the teams. I was talking to one person that was part of one of the teams, and he said, you know, he didn't really want to make that decision himself as it got closer, but it was obviously something he was looking at. So for them to look out for the well-being of the athletes and to make that decision first, and I think it was inevitable anyways. I think they could look ahead and see that and realize and understand that, you know, it just was not a safe situation for the athletes and, you know, withdraw from that. And then as it turns out, you know, the IOC decides to postpone anyways, and we'll see where it goes from here.
Yeah. I was talking to Kyle Peters a little bit, obviously the caddy for Corey Connors. He was a little disappointed when the announcement first came out, but understanding. But you know, I think this is a good thing for people to realize and get ahead of curve. This isn't weeks that we keep talking about. You know, you're not going to be in your house for the next couple of weeks. You're not going to be in your house for the next, you know, 4 weeks. This is probably a couple months before things even get close to normal. And maybe this is a good transition to the next topic of just golf courses opening in general. I'm starting, you know, a few weeks ago, I was believing, you know, okay, maybe they'll open it up and maybe it'll just be walking only. And, you know, you can't touch the flagstick, but I'm starting to believe that we might be looking at 6 weeks, a month past normal opening date, just to, you know, not only for the political landscape, because that does play a big part in a lot of these businesses opening, whether we like it or not, but also just from the health standpoint. I just don't see it happening.
Yeah, from a legal standpoint right now, obviously there's restrictions in our own province here where we record this in Ontario as far as non-essential businesses. There had been restrictions already put in place in Quebec and in New Brunswick as well. And that was sort of to be expected. And I think most people are realizing, again, this is for, you know, a long-term situation. And, you know, while there might have been some advantages to, you know, getting open right away and getting a few people out there, in the end, you know what, the faster that we can get everybody as healthy as possible, the faster we're going to be able to return back to the golf course. So seeing that happen now, it's very unfortunate. Obviously, it's going to impact our business a lot. And when I say our business, I mean the golf industry as a whole. But I think when, you know, everybody looks at it, it's probably the right choice right now for the long term of everything.
And yeah, and I mean, from Flagstick standpoint, obviously we've announced our own tournament. We're still taking that day by day, and we'll keep you guys updated once we actually have any updates we can give you about the Flagstick Open. But it's going to be a tough time for everyone, not just the golf industry, literally any industry that is considered a non-essential industry. But, you know, we can go on about this. You're hearing it all day. We're going to try to take it a little bit of a different route today. And we're going to have some fun on the podcast as well. You and I did a little bit of we hinted at last week that we were going to watch one of the previous Masters and then we're going to break it down a little bit. So we did just that. We're going to break it down after our interview when we watched the 2003 Masters, which, you know, if this is the first one we're going with, we have to go with Mike Weirs.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, as Canadians, I think that's, you know, we're obligated to do that. I'm not sure how old you were for the 2003 one, but
14,
there you go. So, you know, this event had an impact on a lot of people in different ways. And it's kind of interesting to get people's, you know, their thoughts as far as different generations. And it was neat for me to even go back. And I mean, it's, I think it's almost 5 hours the recording is. And I went back, and this is the final round that's available in the Masters channel on YouTube. And you know, it was really neat to go back and see that. And, you know, we won't get into it yet, but we certainly have different observations of it, I think, just from looking at our notes. But I think it's something that a lot of people are interested in doing right now. I mean, a lot of people are at home trying to find some things to do, trying to find some things to watch. And I know I've had a lot of communication with people that were really interested by, you know, this being available to go back and see 50 years of the Masters, the final rounds being available. You know, they're maybe just tired of watching another movie. They want some action. You know, they know that the Masters is obviously going to be postponed and they're not going to get to see it. So this gives them a little bit of substitute. And I think it'll be fun for us just to talk through that round.
Absolutely. So we'll get to that after the interview. Speaking of the interview, who do we have this week? We got a couple other topics to get to, but we may as well hint at who we're chatting with this week.
Yeah, Brendan Webb's going to join us, who's a Canadian as well. And, you know, we'll probably get his take, too, on what his memories were for that Masters in 2003. And Brendan is currently the men's head coach of the University of Tennessee, their golf program. And people may not be familiar, but most of them will be, in the fact that the NCAA obviously closed down their sporting activities, and most of the schools went to online education. So the NCAA did shut down the athletics, and that obviously had a big impact on these programs. And for him and his golf program, they really were surging. In fact, they actually won just before the end of the season, the unexpected end of the season. So it'll be interesting to get his comments, and also talk a little bit too about his ascension from being just a junior golfer in the Muskoka area of Ontario to eventually working his way through pro golf, a caddy as well, and then becoming the head coach at one of the most storied programs in the NCAA.
Yeah, and we'll get to that interview shortly, and obviously looking forward to hearing how he had some of those discussions with those players where that ended up being their last tournament without even realizing it. So we'll get to that in a little bit. I almost said sadly, which I think it's the right word. Sadly, there's still golf being played at a professional level right now. Most notably, the Outlaw Tour just last weekend had an event. It was a great weekend for a couple Canadians at the event, one shooting 59, but I was just shocked to see they're still grinding it out on the Outlaw Tour. It's, you know, it's just, you wonder what they're thinking. I mean, it's not like there's fans there, but still.
No, and it is kind of odd. And the West Florida Tour was the same thing. They had an event just yesterday down in Florida. And, you know, they put in all sorts of regulations and things in place. That said, yeah, considering, you know, obviously a lot of people are heading for home, you know, the shelter in place situations in California, there's all sorts of different things that are going on. You'd think that, you know, playing a professional golf and especially at this level, it's not like they're playing for millions of dollars. You know, you're going to gain maybe a couple $1,000 if you, you win it. The fact that they're still playing is, sort of, dumb. You know, it causes you to make a pause. That's for sure. So
it's dumb. And I mean, we have friends out there playing on that tour, fellow Canadians like Aaron Cockerill, who we've had on this podcast. He had a good week. Oh,
I was actually Aaron Crawford.
Sorry.
Bad notes by me.
Yeah, my bad. I always get those two screwed up. Aaron Cockerill's out on the European tour. Aaron Crawford, my apologies, was playing out there. But I mean, one good positive, I guess, considering if we talk about just the golf that was happening, Jared Dutrois shot 59 out there. Still lost.
Yeah. To a fellow Canadian and, you know, another Western Canadian guy, Will Bateman from Edmonton ended up with the win. Three of the players ended up at 19 under. And then I'm not sure how many holes the playoff went, but whatever the case, you know, Jared probably got a lot more attention for shooting 59. But, you know, there were certainly a lot of 60s and 61s on the scoreboard. This is the course, actually, Moon Valley, where Annika shot her 59 on the LPGA Tour, which made it kind of interesting as well. But Aaron Crawford tied for fourth, and there were a number of other Canadians in the field there as well.
Yeah, so I mean, professional golf is for some reason still being played. It probably will continue.
We'll see for how much longer. Yeah,
I mean, here's the thing, right? We don't know. Like, the president came out with some comments today of, you know, we got to open up America again, which is, you know, I'm not a medical expert, but I'm not saying that's what I would recommend. But so who knows what happens and what the pressure is on sports leagues to start up again with or without fans, right? Like, if they open up the borders and they, because they're talking about the economy and the need to have these things, maybe there's a pressure from from the government to be like, hey, you know, the NHL, the NBA, we need you to play whether there's fans or not on. Kind of a scary thought to, you know, think that a lot of this might even come to be outside of, you know, the commissioner's control.
Yeah, the other side of that, though, is that, you know, you have to consider liability as well. I mean, I saw a note today that, you know, one university was talking about, you know, restarting again and having students go back to school. And, you know, the issue there is, you know, what happens for people that get sick or people that die as a result of that? So, yeah, liability becomes a part of it as well. And you know what, again, these tours might not have a, they might not have a choice eventually. Their states might just say, sorry, you can't do this anymore. So, we'll see. And I'm certainly, I would think as well, there's players that are, you know, pulling out of that outlaw tour event. There was actually on the women's side of it, there were two Canadians that were initially in the field, and one of them was Elena Sharp, and she withdrew. She said she just didn't feel right about it. It was actually interesting because her name was on the draw, and I actually tweeted it out that the fact it was on the draw, and she responded right away saying, no, I'm not in the field. And then, you know, just had a quiet private discussion, and basically, you know, she's made that known as well to, you know, to Golf Week as well now that, yeah, she just didn't feel comfortable. And she'll return to play when the LPGA returns to play, which could be a while from now.
Yeah, speaking of which, the LPGA obviously has postponed more events, and, you know, this is probably the norm rather than not the norm for, you know, the great... I don't even know where I'm going with that. I don't care. But regardless, yeah, another three events being postponed, Hawaii, the LA Open, and one more on there as well. So basically at this point, we're looking at what, May 3rd, yeah, as the earliest. Obviously their first major bumped back to September. Like, I just, you know, it sucks. I promise we are going to get to some fun in this podcast at some point. it does suck, but like this, yeah. I just feel like we're just going to be pushing, you know, I'm starting to believe, and I was one on the other side originally thinking, you know, maybe this is a couple weeks. I'm starting to believe we're not going to see professional sports on TV or anything until earliest late June.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, we don't know that for sure. But obviously we have to plan for, and the tour is planning for those provisions. So the LPGA, you know, Commissioner Mike Wan has said, you know, he's getting creative. He's trying to think what they're going to do. There's been discussion about, you know, super events where they're basically, you know, doubling up the sponsors on a particular event. As we said, the ANA is now bumped back to September. It's taken the week where the Cambia Portland Classic was, which gets bumped back a week. It's just what they have to do. You know, like you said, it'd be nice to be all rosy about how this is going to go, but unfortunately we're going to have some hardships first before the, you know, the sunshine comes back out.
Absolutely. And I think this is a good time to head to our interview, where I think we'll probably start with some of those hardships, as I think one of the hardest things a coach, you know, you don't prepare for a conversation telling your, you know, your senior players, you know, this actually was your last tournament, and thank you for everything you did. Usually you get that send off, and I do wonder how Brennan had that conversation, took that conversation, and, you know, what his conversations with his team look like right now.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we'll get that insight from him and see as well. The NCAA did allow some eligibility for the seniors for next year. So we'll see if any of his players have decided to take advantage of that. But certainly he can give us the insight on how his season ended so oddly.
Yeah, why don't we head over and chat with Brennan? After that, we'll talk about the 2003 Masters. We got a couple of little fun events we're going to do on the back half, and we're going to turn this into a positive podcast from here on out. I've been sending you ideas every day of things we can do on this podcast over the next couple of weeks. We don't want to throw them all in this podcast, but why don't we send it to Brennan, then we'll come back with some fun. I promise you that. So without further ado, Brennan Webb.
Okay, we want to welcome to the podcast Brennan Webb, who is the men's head coach at the University of Tennessee and a fellow Canadian. How you doing, Brennan?
I'm doing great, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Obviously, it was a sudden end to the year, unexpected with obviously the COVID-19 pandemic coming along and the NCAA deciding to end the season quite early. I mean, how was that for you, and especially with your players as well in dealing with that?
Yeah, obviously at first, just quite a shock. at the time, we didn't quite understand the level of the COVID-19 and what it was going to do to the world that we know. And so just kind of getting over that originally, and then eventually just figure out how serious it is and how important it is for everyone to stay inside and self-quarantine. And when they canceled the Masters, and pretty much figured out the NCAA could go sideways pretty easily.
Absolutely. Now, you guys ended with a win in San Diego. That was I think it was the fifth win under your helm in the last 2 years with the University of Tennessee. What was the team trending like this year? Obviously, they were pretty solid. You guys had a lot of success the prior year, but you were trending nicely.
Yeah, we had finally kind of gotten to where we had been working for the last 18 months, and finally got the feel of a program that felt like we belonged with the big boys. And obviously was excited to see how the rest of the year was going to go. But it looks like they're going to give this eligibility back to the seniors. And so we'll give it another go next year.
So they just recently announced that. Prior to announcing that, what were the conversations like with your players, not knowing if this actually was going to be their last tournament or not?
Yeah, it was kind of heartbreaking for some of them to see. And it was a lesson, that you can't take any of this stuff for granted. And a lot of times you see in college golf, guys get here for the first couple of years, and then all of a sudden that fifth semester comes, you're like, oh my God, I'm halfway done. And now these guys that have gone through this, they finally figured it out that you can't take this stuff for granted. And 4 years goes by really, really fast. And it's, for most people, the last opportunity they're going to have to play golf on a team. And these guys got to thinking how much that how much it's meant to them. And they've realized that the last couple of weeks, and we've had some pretty emotional conversation. So I hope that, they do get another chance at it, and we get to go have another run at it next year.
How many seniors have you got that are going to take advantage of that?
We have three seniors. I've talked to a couple of them. Two of them are definitely coming back. One's in a unique situation. He's in New Zealand. He's graduating in December. Still haven't kind of chatted with him fully, but I would imagine he'll come back as well.
And, what does this mean for you when you look at things like recruiting and what's going to happen this summer as well? Obviously, this is going to have an impact on that.
Yeah, it's going to have to wait and see what the final decision is, how the scholarships are going to work, if everybody's going to get a year eligibility back or just the seniors. If everyone gets a year back, then that, and we've already got guys committed, through the 2022 season graduating class. And so for those guys, they're all pushed back as well. So there's a lot of moving parts to this. It's not just simply here's a year of eligibility left. There's a lot of questions that need to be answered, and we really can't move forward in those regards until we get those answers.
Yeah, even think about that. You push everybody back 1 year. Now those kids come out of high school, a lot of those guys, that's, a very important development year to be on the team. And if you're pushing everyone's back, well, how do you balance that as a coach? Do I take somebody young with the potential, or do I take somebody I know what they already have? It's got to be a really tough experience. And I mean, it's not like you're going to have an answer right now because everything really is up in the air.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I'm in a unique situation. I had four guys come with me from Middle Tennessee to Tennessee. So we already have a bigger roster than is ideal. And so now you add a couple more guys that were signed up to come next year, and guys not leaving, and that makes that roster even bigger. And you had guys redshirt this year that were going to come back and start their freshman year. And now you wonder if this could mean they have to redshirt again or how it goes. But yeah, you're right. There's just so many unanswered questions that right now I'm just driving myself crazy thinking about all the different possibilities.
So for you, Brandon, obviously that transition is a little bit from, your history in the game, especially as a coach as well. And, you've been away from Canada for a while, but, you grew up in Bracebridge, Ontario, and worked your way all the way up to where you are now in the game. But let's talk a little bit about that pathway, because, there are a few more Canadian coaches now in the NCAA, both on the men's and the women's side, but it's not really a common thing, let's say. So for you, why don't you kind of make people a little bit familiar with what it was like, first off, growing up in Bracebridge and your dad being a pro and your mom managing the shop and your sister also playing?
Yeah, I was very fortunate, obviously, the setup that I was born into with my parents running the golf course. We lived right on the 11th tee. I was afforded every opportunity that I could ever dream of having to advance as far as I could in golf, and certainly thank my parents for all of that. Both my sister and I took advantage of it, and I was happy with you know, just how far that I was able to make it as a professional, and now to be able to move into this and transition to coaching has been a dream, and couldn't think of any other way. But I've been very, very fortunate at every step of the way, and thankful for everybody that's helped.
Well, let's go back, because I do want to touch on Muskoka. Is one of, I mean, it's hard to say it's an unknown gem, because it's very known. But what is life growing up in Muskoka? I think a lot of people, you know, think of it as cottage country, and you know, only the summers. Were you were there year long as a kid, and what was that like? Because this is, you know, Muskoka for me is one of my favorites in our entire province and our entire country, but you often don't see what that looks like in the middle of the winter.
Yeah, it was not the same. Certainly a lot less people hanging around, easier to get a table at the restaurant and a stool at the bar. But certainly great people. My lifelong friends still there, some of them, and I'm always anxious to go back and see them. But yes, winter was hockey and basketball and snowmobiling and all the fun things that Canadians do when they grow up in the North.
Now, you ended up going to East Tennessee State. That was sort of your start with the NCAA and the system. Obviously, you ended up transitioning that into, you know, thinking about playing professionally and, you know, making that decision. But, you know, you taught a little bit first as well. When did you make the choice that you wanted to get involved with the professional game?
I mean, I've always wanted to. I just, when I left college, I didn't think that I was good enough, to be honest with you, Scott. And I needed to go work at it. And being able to teach lessons at South Muskoka afforded me a chance to make some money. I went away to Florida for a couple winters, came back, finally got my Canadian tour card, played out there for 4 or 5 years, and then was finally able to get through to the final stage of PGAQ school, back when it was real Q school. You're playing for your PGA tour card. And so to be able to go play 6 rounds at PGA West and the finals of Q school, and then got fully exempt on, at the time, was the nationwide tour. It was fun. It was a long, hard journey. I probably wasn't good enough to make it all the way, but there certainly wasn't anyone that worked harder. I'm extremely proud to look back now and say there was nothing else I could have done. And I turned over every leaf and did everything I possibly could. And I was thankful for that opportunity that other people provided for me. And it certainly has helped be a good college golf coach, I think, to go through that situation and not be the superstar kid that came easy for. Understand what these guys are going through. Remember how hard this game is. And it's a process and it's a hard thing to do. And so as a coach, it's easy to look back sometimes and say, why would you do that? And then think, man, I did that thousands and thousands of times. So I feel like,
I mean, how often does that come up in talking to the, you know, the kids and, you know, do they ask you questions about that and what it's like to be a pro?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's something that we talk about all the time, not only from my own experience, but the people that I was fortunate enough to be around. And the great players that I got to spend so much time with, it's nice to be able to tell them those stories, to tell them about the times that I failed, to tell them about the times that I struggled, how hard it was, to feel like I wasn't ever going to make it, and to get over that hump, and what shooting 81 felt like when it mattered. All of those things are just as important as, you know, shooting 66 in the final stage of Q school at PJ West, or you know, shooting 60 and 62s in the last rounds of tournaments to win. The struggles are the things that you learn the lessons from. And so I've just been able to help them with that. And I think that's something that they appreciate.
Well, one of the things we do have in common, because we don't have the professional golf, the college golf, or any of the talent that you have in common, is we both carried a bag on the PGA Tour a couple times. You did it while playing on the web.com tour, though. Is that correct?
I don't think I did any of the times out that year that I actually had full status. I did it a couple times as I was going up, and then the year after I lost my card on the nationwide, I played one more year, but I was studying, do my licenses, certifications for financial planning. And I was lucky enough to caddy for some guys on tour, and then John Houston on the senior tour. But not. I don't think I caddied any time the year that I actually had status.
Well, what did you learn from caddying that you've taken over to coaching? Because I think that's, you know, there's a lot in there that, you know, when you're following the guys around an event right now, it's not obviously you're trying to get them to change their swing, might just be a small detail of course management than anything. But, you know, what did you learn from those years caddying that you've brought to your coaching career?
Well, essentially now during tournaments, we're caddying without carrying the club. So all the good parts of caddying.
All the best parts. Yeah,
exactly. So just to understand, you know, what those guys were thinking at certain times and certain situations. And then to understand that sometimes you just need to be quiet. and let them go about their way and figure out their own kind of what they're dealing with at that time. Certainly less is more, especially when we're dealing with college kids who are a little bit insecure compared to those guys on the PGA Tour. And so just understand that, you know, positivity is the thing that works the most when you're under the gun. There's plenty of times to work on stuff and get on each other's butt to get working harder. But it's, you know, during the guts, they got enough stuff going on and you don't need to add to it. So just try to encourage them and help them and make sure they're making clear decisions and to let them know that, you know, you're on their side.
Well, when you don't have to carry the bag, you can actually just walk away from them when you want to, I guess, at that point too, right? You know, when you're carrying it out on the tour, you can't just leave a guy's bag and be like, I'll meet you at the next hole and see if you're in a better mood then. You gotta go through it. So that must be a nice change at least.
Yeah, I can duck in and grab a chocolate bar if I need to. It's nice to be able to have that freedom. And sometimes, believe me, they want you to leave. It just like I'm sure when I've had caddies that I wanted to leave as well.
So for you then, you know, you caddy for a while. When did the coaching aspect come along for you? I mean, I know USF, University of South Florida, was your first big opportunity, I think, for that. How did you transition into that?
It's funny. I'd always thought it's something that I wanted to do. At the time, you couldn't make a whole bunch of money coaching college golf, especially starting off. But I can remember I was caddying for John Houston up at the Senior Players Championship at Westchester, New York. I was studying for some exams in my hotel room at night. And was just bouncing around the internet and saw that the University of South Florida had a job opening for assistant golf coach. I lived in Tampa. That's where I played and practiced, met my wife. So I figured, you know, if there was ever going to be a chance that I'd try it, then that would be the time. Called Chris Malloy. He's now the head coach of the University of Mississippi, one of my closest friends in the world. But at the time, I'd never met Chris, didn't know him at all. But I just called him, talked to him on the phone that night for an hour or so, and just kept hounding him. And that was probably mid-August. And finally, he tried to hire some other people, I'm sure, and never really found someone. He was not paying any money at all. My wife, we had just had a baby. My wife was pregnant again with our second child. And he said, dude, I am not hiring you. You know, you can't afford to live. And I said, I have some money saved up and from caddying, playing a little bit, and I'd love to try it. Just give me a chance. No one else is going to do it. And so I did. And loved it, every minute of it, from the minute I started and got very, very fortunate. Was there for a year and then got offered the assistant coach position at Georgia Tech, which at the time was an unbelievable feeling and blessing, and very fortunate. Was able to make a living after that. And so 1 year and then got to go.
Yeah, I mean, Georgia Tech, you know, obviously is a very well-established program, has put a lot of players onto the next level. You're able to work with athletes like Ollie Schneider-Jans there, some other great athletes as well. I mean, what's the big step up when you go from, you know, and no disrespect to USF, but obviously going to Georgia Tech is kind of a whole different level. What were the biggest changes that you found?
You know, just being around world-class athletes. And there was a group of them there, five of them or six of them have played on the PGA Tour already of that first team that I got to at Georgia Tech. And just to see, you know, just kind of be reminded of why people are great. And those guys epitomize that every minute of every day. And they really, really helped me kind of get an understanding of what the elite level of college golf looked like. And those guys are, I owe a lot to, and will hopefully remain close to them forever and ever.
My buddies would destroy me if I didn't ask this, and it's completely kind of off topic. Why doesn't Ollie wear a hat?
He loves his hair. Now he played baseball growing up and hated wearing a hat and quit baseball when he was 11 years old and told everybody I'm never wearing a hat again. So I've seen him in some relaxed times, maybe later in the evening, he'll have a hat on backwards, but that's the only time.
Wow. I've always wondered, this is why we do the podcast. We bring the questions that the people always wanted to know to them. That's awesome. So you from Georgia Tech, you obviously ended up being a head coach. What was the first time you were able to be a head coach? And what was that phone call like knowing that you got to there?
It was funny. I'd had some opportunities when I was at Georgia Tech and nothing really fit in my mind. Maybe some programs that people might think were a little bit better than where I ended up in name. But stayed at Georgia Tech for 3 years. Remember the summer before Ollie left, or before he had his senior year, I called him and I'd been offered a head coaching job. And I said, are you coming back for your senior year? And he said, yeah, I'm coming back. I said, all right, I'm coming back too then. And we went back and gave it another run, ended up coming just short at the NCAA championship again. But had a great friend. His name was Whit Turnbow. He was the head coach at Middle Tennessee State, and he was going into the administration. And he called me up and he said, "Hey, come up here and come be the head coach at Middle Tennessee." So, but I love you and I respect the heck out of you, but I am not going to be the coach at Middle Tennessee. I didn't even really know what Middle Tennessee was, to be honest with you.
Sounds like the middle of nowhere, literally.
He said, "Come up here and have lunch." So I did, and got up there Friday at 11 o'clock in the morning and called my wife at 3 o'clock, and she completely understood where my head was when I got there when I left in the morning. And I told her, I said, "I think I'm going to take this job." And she said, "Whatever. What time are you going to be home for dinner?" And I said, "No, I'm being serious. I think I'm going to take this job." And her, knowing me very, very, very well and knows what makes me happy, she said, "Brennan, can you win there?" And I said, "Yeah, I think I can." And at the time, they were 160th in the country. And we had gotten, they had gotten a new facility, a new golf course that was just being built outside of town that was going to be their home golf course. And for whatever reason, I just had that feeling that this was the place that I needed to go. And I went and had a tremendous amount of success in 3 years as there, and was fortunate enough to get this job based on that decision.
I mean, you've spent part of your life now in Tennessee. You obviously have an affinity for the state, and, you know, University of Tennessee is revered, the Volunteers. You know, what was the sense of pride for you? And I remember seeing the press conference and the signing, and I could see the smile on your face. But, you know, what was the personal feelings that day and knowing that, you know, you were sort of at that pinnacle of not only your career, but, you know, being in that program, that elite program?
Yeah, it was just an overwhelming sense of thankfulness, to be honest. I just couldn't believe that I'd been afforded this opportunity, and to get here my seventh year in coaching, to have, you know, this blessing given to me, and to think of all the people that had helped me get there, and my wife and kids and everything they'd put up with in my chase of my professional career, and then being an assistant coach and doing all those things. And so, you know, it's just to be able to be handed this opportunity I was just thankful more than anything.
I think it's underselling yourself by saying, you know, handed this opportunity. It's been earned, as we've kind of gone over your career. You know, hard work pays off. You talked about that in the beginning, right? And what you sell your players on is that you felt like you were the hardest working guy out on the Nationwide or the web.com or the Nike Tour, whatever it was called at that point. And it sounds like you carry that onto your coaching career and so on. And that's what you're constantly trying to teach your players now. So I think it's unfair to yourself to say it's been handed, and that you're still trying to pass those lessons on every single day.
Yeah. I remember I was fortunate enough to go to the World Junior Hockey Championship in Germany in 1991, I think. And I remember on this outside their door on the dressing room, they had a sign that said, "Hard work make dreams come true." And I wrote that down and had it on my binder that I carried with me. And I just remember that, you know, hard work makes dreams come true. And I've been just tried to follow that as far as I can.
Awesome. Just a couple more things for you. One thing I want to get your take. Obviously, you pay attention to it because you're obviously looking for athletes and stuff all the time. I know we've messaged a few times when, you know, you were going to come up for recruiting trips and things. But, you know, what's your sense now when you look at the Canadian golf scene and the players that are coming up, and obviously on the professional level and the collegiate level as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Golf Canada's done, the commitment they've made to the national program here in the last 10 years is paying off. What Derek and Robert and Tristan have done with the national team, and Matt, these guys are just going to keep putting out good players. And Golf Canada keeps putting the support into it, it's going to continue to grow. And to see what Corey and Adam and all these guys out on tour now are doing, it's crazy to think, you know, when we were growing up, this just didn't seem possible. You had one or two guys, but now that they're contending and being up in the leaderboards every week, it's amazing. And it just goes to show you what that support has done. And it's awesome.
One of those players that led the way is a guy we're going to talk about tonight later on our podcast. We broke down the 2003 Masters and talking about Mike Weir's win. What are your personal memories of that championship and what it meant to you?
It was, I can just remember being where I was when I watched it, and the first memory I have of was when Mike played with Tiger in the final round of the PGA at Medina, and I was vacuuming the shop, and he was just getting worn out. No one was paying attention to him being there. And I remember that being encouraging to me and kind of, you know, moving me along in my own game and just that feeling. But then to see him follow that up, winning in Vancouver and then winning the Masters and winning three times that year, it was amazing. And obviously he was the catalyst for all of this and what he's done for all of the guys that came behind him. And it's it was amazing. I can just remember sitting there in the clubhouse at South Muskoka watching it and him making that putt on 18 and then, you know, him going ahead and beating Len Matisse in the playoff. It was funny. I played with Len Matisse in the Mexican Open a couple of years later, and I'm thinking, man, this guy was in the playoff for the Masters. Now he's got to play golf with me.
Well, that's great. Now, you mentioned the South Muskoka Curling and Golf Club. We'll wrap it up with this. You know, eventually we're going to get back to normal here in North America, and we're going to be playing golf again. And eventually, you know, tourism's going to be back up in the Muskoka. So if you know, buddies, you know, husband and wives, families are planning their trip, give us your top five favorite golf courses in the Muskokas, your must play golf courses. If you know, the distance doesn't really matter, they can go to Port Perry all the way to Huntsville. It doesn't really matter. Give us your top five courses they got to play.
Well, obviously number one is South Muskoka Curling and Golf Club. That goes without saying. Okay. For me, number two would be Big One. My dad was a pro at Big One Island in the 1960s at the original golf course. And so that's always kind of been close to my heart. To go play just the 18th hole alone out there is amazing to see that view from up there on that tee. I would say Rocky Crest would be number three for me. Taboo, number four. And Lake Joe Club would be number five.
Nice. A good set there, a good list for people to follow, especially as we get back to eventually get back to normal. We really appreciate your input, really appreciate your insight as well, especially to all these different topics. I mean, you know, everything from NCAA to caddying. Wish you continued success. You've done a great job. Your career has been amazing, been fun to follow. And certainly we appreciate you coming on and sharing all this with us.
Thanks, guys. Keep up good work. I'll keep following you on social media and listen to the podcast. It's great stuff.
Thank you, Brennan, for that interview. Great insight. The most important question I always wanted answered is, why does Ollie Schneiderjans not wear a hat? And I got the answer, and that's all I need. You know, we can end the podcast here.
It's nice to get it from a source that close to the action. And for all that great content within the podcast, that was a pretty neat note just to hear that from him.
Yeah, well, you know, I appreciate it. As a bald man, I appreciate when, you know, people recognize they have good hair and they show it off. And you know, now I'm a fan of Ollie just for that, knowing why. He just didn't like hats and he wants to show off his hair, so here it is. And I love that answer, so appreciate it. Another thing we did get into with Brennan was the 2003 Masters, which we talked about earlier, that you and I both sat down this Sunday. We threw on the 2003 Masters from start to finish. Obviously, I skipped a little bit. You know, I don't need to watch the first couple holes, but watch the start. And, you know, going back, it's crazy to think that Tiger Woods was the first shot on TV during that Masters, as he somehow came back into contention a little bit. He was only four back starting the Sunday at minus one after somehow making the cut at 76-73. It was a really cool experience, though, and just watching that start and everything. I don't want to give you shot by shot, obviously, but it was just a cool experience to go back. And, you know, for me, I was 14 at the time when that Masters took place, wasn't a golfer by any stretch of the imagination. So to go back now, even knowing where it was going, I was excited the entire way.
I mean, how many details did you see there that, you know, did you remember any of it at all? I mean, or just sort of the end of it? How clear was it for you?
Definitely just the end of it. For me, as I said, I wasn't really a golfer. I do remember watching it a little bit because my dad, that was like the biggest moment. And he had a ton of people over watching it at the time as all his buddies were over. And it was a big thing. We always had the photo of Mike on the 18th green with his hands in the air after he won on the wall. And he still has it up in his office. But like in terms of memories, no, that was all very fresh right down to, you know, that final putt. It was very, very fresh.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they started with, you know, Tiger hitting his tee shot because he had won the two previous Masters, was the number one player in the world, was garnering all the attention at that time. And you know what? Even though he obviously bobbled a few things early on, he got back somewhere near the lead. He ended up tied for 15th in the end. But were you kind of surprised that how much, I don't know, pomp and circumstance there was around Tiger and how much they were following every shot?
I mean, not really. If you're thinking like the story would have, the best story, obviously for Canada, the best story is Mike Weir winning. We needed that. The best story though of that week would have been Tiger Woods winning three in a row. And that's obviously what every producer that was working behind the scenes that week was hoping for. So when he's teeing off, you're going to follow that. He just came off a 66 on the Saturday. You know, from a guy that went 76, 73 and then shoots 66, you're probably thinking, you know, knowing Tiger Woods and he just won the last two, this is it. Like, he's only four back. He's got this. And then first tee shot ends up in the bunker and nothing really went great after that for him.
No. Yeah, I mean, he was like four over, I think, early. Well, he was four over early. So I'm sure that deflated, you know, every producer, everybody in the truck thinking, oh, we're going to, you know, this is going to be a TV juggernaut for ratings. He's going to get this three in the row and not so much. But, you know, in the end, as we've talked about, you know, a lot of stories emerged out of that, including Mike Weir.
Yeah, it was awesome. Couple things that I want to note that stuck out to me. The sponsorships were just hilarious to me. What the heck is Bearing Point? I have no idea. Strata was a big sponsor. McGregor was out there. Phil was still playing Titleist back then. He had that.
Somehow I knew you'd be checking out all the hats. Phil ended up playing. He played Titleist until the next year, 2004. Yeah. He actually signed with Callaway.
So he was rocking that Scotty Cameron Futura putter. Is one of the ugliest putters of all time. And actually one of my first putters, I stole it from my dad. He had a Futura himself. He probably bought it right after that Masters.
Probably.
And when I saw it, it just brought so much joy to me. I was wondering, you know, it was a putter that, you know, I probably sold, or, you know, when I didn't even own it, I took it from my dad and sold it probably because I needed beer money when I was 20 or something like that. But it was like, I really wish I kept on to that thing. That thing was so ugly.
Yeah, you could probably find one now pretty cheap on eBay, but it certainly stood out at the time. And, you know, for Phil ended up not, you know, he ended up winning the next year and he didn't have it in the bag. So obviously it didn't work out too well for him. But
with him, because the whole, you know, at that point he hadn't won a major, right? And all I know is him as, you know, this five-time major champion, right? You know, and then it's here, it's still like, oh, the best player without a major. How about that accent? Mm. Not a big deal. But that's the whole thing they're going on is, when will he get one? When will he get one? And they right. said, it's almost foreshadowing. It's funny. It's crazy. You go back and it's like, did they add this earlier or after? Because they're like, you know, Phil said this is the best chance is right here at Augusta that he will to win his first major. And he goes on the next year and that's what he does. It was just, it was a very cool experience for me to watch that and wonder, you know, to go back in history. I recommend anyone to do this. And we're going to talk about how we're going to probably do more of these going forward.
Sure.
The other thing that really stood out to me is where the guys were hitting it from off the tee and their second shots did not feel any different to me than what we're watching. You know, if we even go back to last year, am I crazy? Am I just off base? Were the tees in a different spot? I don't know.
Well, the big move for the golf course was after the 97 Masters. I mean, obviously back then, you know, the course was under 7,000 yards then, and they've kept creeping it further and further. But in most cases, a lot of the holes that you saw there weren't changed too much from what you see right now. There was been some expansion on holes like 5 and 11. The tee went back to, you know, 505 all the way back there. But yeah, you're right. I mean, Phil was pounding the ball. I mean, he was leading the driving during the week. And on one hole, I saw him hit one like 361. So it's not like guys weren't really hitting it. And another note quickly before I forget, you were mentioning the foreshadowing. I mean, Lee Westwood was leading, but for some reason, they decided to open with Bryan Adams' song as the opening montage. I don't know if you ever caught that.
It wasn't Lee Westwood. I don't want you get in trouble. It was Jeff Maggart. Sorry. Jeff Maggart was leading.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I don't want to. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It's all good. It's all good.
Yeah. And maybe he looks like Bryan Adams. I don't know. But you're right. I mean, eventually Westwood got in there after Maggard got in trouble on the third hole after hitting himself. But yeah, for them to start with this music by Bryan Adams, that seemed a little bit like foreshadowing as well. Not that I noticed it at that point, but I noticed it now looking back afterwards. I thought, oh, that was kind of an odd choice.
Yeah, no, I didn't even pick up on that. But it's funny, we talk about Jeff Maggard. Two holes destroyed this guy from a Masters, and he never got close after that to anything. He never won a major in his career. He did, you go into a Sunday at Augusta with 2-stroke lead. It's not a big lead,
no,
but
not
you
at all.
Take away those two holes and he ends up winning. It's tough to see, especially with hitting yourself, which that rule doesn't exist anymore, but at the time is obviously a big penalty. You had another note, Rich Beem. I believe that was his first Masters as a professional. He was like skinny.
even he'd look back and laugh at that, right? But yeah, he had won the PGA the year prior, and you know, he had some great shots in there, and you know, he was still the guy. You know, his story was still vivid at that point. Everybody knew him winning the PGA the year before, and there's talk of him being a cell phone salesman, and you know, here is him in Augusta now, you know, this guy from a cell phone salesman from Texas that you know, he holed out on one of the holes. He almost holed out another shot, and you know, for the fact that he wasn't on the front of the leaderboard, he wasn't on the first page, but he certainly got a lot of airtime.
Yeah, I thought that was true. And Lee Matisse obviously got a ton of airtime, obviously went on to lose in the playoff. We'll get into that in a second, but
yeah,
you know, he came out of nowhere. Obviously the front nine, they're not gonna show him because he was even starting the day, shot 65. It was insane that he, and this is a guy as noted in that, in the interview with Brennan, like never to be seen again. Like he went on to play
Mexican Opens with Brennan a few years later. Yeah.
Yeah. And club pro guy was probably in that tournament for all we know. Right. Like it's crazy. That, you know, that one, he's obviously, I think he choked it away, and we'll get to the playoff in a sec. I there's some other notes I just want to get to. The amateurs in the field, talk about some guys that went on to have great careers. You know, Ricky Barnes, you know, of the three, maybe, you know, the least name you know, Hunter Mahan, who's obviously not been great of late, but a guy that was, you know, on leaderboards every single weekend for 10 years, it felt like. And Ryan Moore, the guy that just never quits with that loopy swing, and what a, you know, couple big amateurs in the field. It was cool.
Yeah, it was neat to see them. I mean, despite Ricky Barnes's Hawaiian shirt that he was rocking in the final round there.
I dug it.
But, you know, they were the three amateurs that made the cut and obviously became elite players. And you know, they proved that their skills were strong. And, you know, they obviously had highlights beyond that as professionals as well at Masters after that. So, yeah, it was neat to see. And that's always a fun part of the Masters, is to see those top amateurs and see how they perform. And it's even more fun to go back and remember they were amateurs at that point and playing and how they played.
Yeah. And I think the turning point for me, and when I really was just fully engaged, was when Matisse made that eagle on 13. It was like, holy moly, here we go. And it was like, wait, hold on. You know how this is going to finish, right? You know, they're going to get to that playoff. And even though I knew that putt on 18, that Weir hits just to get in that playoff, you know, you leave a putt that short on your, you know, your first putt, and here you go, you have, you know, 7-8 feet potentially for par on 18 to get in a playoff for the Masters is crazy. And it was just dead weight. Let's go, get me to the 10th tee. And at that point, I think, for lack of a better term, Lee puked all over himself. And
Len,
sorry. Did I say Lee Matisse?
Len. Yeah, you did. That's okay. Lee Westwood was in there. So
yeah, that's your fault.
That's an easy one. I talked to a couple other people as well when I mentioned, you know, that we were doing this for the 2003 Masters, and that's what they talked about as well, how nervous they were watching Weir make that putt. you know, his brother has said it, Jim Weir has mentioned as well that, you know, he was ready to throw up when that was happening. You know, his dad was, or Jim was there, and then their dad was there as well. So for them, imagine watching that, you know, come down, that he'd worked so hard and he'd got himself back into it. And, you know, if all of a sudden he had three putted 18, just think of the swings in the careers that it could have been for Mike Weir and Len Matisse, of different directions they could have gone. Now at that point, you know, this was my, ended up being Mike Weir's third win of the year. He had already won at the Hope, and he had won at Riviera leading into this. So he was already going to have a pretty strong year, but just think how career changing that was for him just to make that putt, and what the difference would have been if that putt had not gone in.
That's crazy to think. And we'll talk about the playoff, I think, real quick. One of the worst playoffs I've ever watched in professional golf history. I don't want to blame Mike. I think Mike actually played the playoff fine. Yeah. His first putt, he's got to assume that, you know, so they both hit the fairway. Len just blasts one to the middle of nowhere behind a tree, just completely blocked out. And Mike hits it into the middle of the green, which is, after you watch that, that's your play. Your caddy, yeah, at this point, sure, his job is give you a number to the middle, hit it to the middle. Len then chips it on. And Mike, you know, he's got 15 feet or whatever. Mike's got to assume he's going to make that, right? You got to assume that.
Yeah.
So Mike goes for it with the birdie and hits it, you know, 5-6 feet by, right? And then Len decides, you know, I have this 15 footer. I'm going to hit it 30 feet off the green.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. It was crazy. It really was. And I mean, it just exploded in his hands. And yeah, I mean, he, you know, he still would have been okay if he'd given himself that, you know, that chance. But yeah, he'd made a mistake. He sort of got himself out of it, got onto the green. But as soon as he hit that first putt and, you know, hits it pretty much off the green, as you said, and then rocketed that one past the hole. So in the end, it didn't even really matter. He didn't even have to hole out because, you know, Weir basically had two putts from a short distance to make bogey and win it.
Exactly. And people chirp, you know, I have buddies that chirp Mike Weir being like, oh, he made bogey to win the Masters in the playoff.
Who cares?
Well, if you look at it, he actually made the smart bogey, because on that next putt, it was literally, I'm just going to hit this close to the hole. He's not making that next one off there. It didn't matter. And that was the right play, and, you know, picked up a win. But, you know, I knew he made bogey in a playoff. I assume Mike was just scrambling as well, but it was just
no.
Mike played it completely. It was a great bogey. It was a smart bogey, and Len just, as I said, puked all over himself. And I'll take that term. But it was exciting. I'm excited to pick another one. I think we've talked about going, you know, to a random one of like the 70s, maybe something,
yeah, I think so.
Something drastically different. So maybe we'll talk about that next week, and maybe we'll just break down different ones leading up to what would be the actual, you know, date of the Masters in a few weeks, which, as we've speculated, might be moved back to October, but we don't have any proof of that, though. Photos of Augusta National in the October, September time look absolutely amazing. And, you know, it gave me a little bit of hope today, because, you know, it's been a rough week for everyone, and seeing those photos, it was like, all right, you know, I can do that. I can wait for an October Masters if it's going to look like that.
Yeah, you know what? The Pumpkin Spice Masters, we'll go for it. We'll take it, whatever we get. And, you know, here's the cool part. If it does happen in October, then think about it. You know, if we get that October Masters and then the Masters the next year, we're going to have two Masters tournaments, you know, within 6 months of each other. So,
that's cool.
You know what? We get a little reward for our patience, hopefully.
I like it. Why don't we hit the mailbag? We didn't do a mailbag last week. There was a lot going on, obviously, and the world, and we kind of just touched on that. So let's hit the mailbag. Scotty, you opened it up earlier today. And yeah, what came into the mailbag this week?
Well, obviously everybody was, you know, they're sitting at home and really jonesing for golf, because they filled up the mailbag pretty quickly. But one thing that got passed on to me, which was something that was going around, and there's a lot of things that are being passed around on the internet right now. Everybody's probably seeing them, different chain things, donations, little games. This was a golf related one, and I happened to see it. It got sent in to us, and I know I've seen some other tour players even fill it out. I know I saw Brad Fritch fill out a version of it on his Facebook page, but basically is a boredom game with a golf nonsense list. And it basically has a series of questions and you're supposed to respond to them, give your answers, and then pass it on to somebody else. So it's got a number of items here that you got to answer, and goes from basically hole in one to, you know, best other things. So why don't I just go through it with you and ask you it, and I'll put in my responses as well. How's that?
Sounds good. Let's do it.
All right. Hole in ones. How many have you got?
Two.
Two. That's one more than me. So that's
got my second this summer. Got my second this summer. Empty clubhouse both times.
Oh yeah. I think you sent me a text that day. you were in shock as well.
Whoops.
Albatross.
No, not even close. I can barely get to a par 5 and 2 if I'm lucky. So, yeah, no, I don't. This one might never happen.
I actually had an albatross before I had a hole in one. How's that? So, wow. But that said, it was a pretty short par 5, so it felt more or less like I was just holing out, making a 2 on a par 4. But hey, whatever. A 2 on a par 5 is a 2 on a par 5, and I managed to do that once. All right, fell down in a bunker. This one's kind of interesting. Have you ever fell down in a bunker?
Yeah, my one buddy, I'm going to give a shout out to Scrut right now. He's going to hear this and know exactly what I'm talking about. I actually had to call in to a hockey game, a men's league game, because I fell in a bunker on a round of golf early in the day and pulled my groin real bad that I was out of commission for 2 weeks. And the next time I showed up, the boys in the locker room were just feeding into me. And I wasn't a guy that really contributed much to the team anyway. So it's not like they missed me out there, but it gave them something to rally around. So yeah, pulled my groin. I was out of hockey for two weeks. I think I missed about a week from golf from it too.
You know, it's funny because really until I saw this question, I didn't really think about it that much and thinking, really, how many people would fall in a bunker? But when I went back and thought about it, I'm like, yeah, you know what? I did one in Las Vegas and actually with a bunch of other writers. And I think it was Bally High. And I had a ball that was plugged up in the face of the bunker. And you can probably find it on the internet because one of the guys that I know from that works for Golf Advisor actually captured it on video and posted on his Instagram page. But it was plugged in there. I went up and tried to play off the side, and well, let's just say my balance wasn't very good, and ended up down in the bottom of the bunker. But I guess it's more common than we think.
Oh, absolutely.
All right, this is one we've probably talked about a little bit before, but you know, it's on pretty much most lists. A favorite course.
See, I could go two directions. I think my favorite course that I've been able to play multiple times, and just I'm going to give a shout out to one in our region because I feel it's needed. I love playing Smuggler's Glen. It's just outside of Gananoque. I find every hole is different. It's very Muskoka-like golf. This has been a Muskoka-like podcast. I played pretty much every course in the Muskoka area, you know, Arizona, Florida, all over. This is one that I never go and not enjoy each hole I play. So I'm giving a shout out to Smuggler's Glen right now with a, you know, a close second to Superstition Mountain down in Arizona, but that's just more of a, like, I got to play that and you didn't more than anything. So,
all right. That's a couple of good ones, different styles than what I'm going to pick. My favorite one, and it's more for fun. It's not because of its, you know, it's got a lot of history to it, and it's not because it's hosting any Open Championships soon, although it hosts some Open qualifiers, is the West Links at North Berwick in Scotland. Just a fun golf course, got some really cool holes on it, some neat designs, the original Redan design. It's got a Brits green that's pretty dramatic and right on the water as well. And that's one that I love. And again, just because it's so much fun to play, and you've got to be really creative to play it, and that's what I love about the game. All right, moving on here. Been to the Masters, which obviously we're talking about the Masters a bunch, but have you been to the Masters?
Nah, this would have been the year to go. You probably could have got tickets for pretty cheap. So, no, I have not. Have you?
Just 2012, I went and did a little roadie with Rich, who's been on the podcast, and Joe that works for us. Joe's buddy got some tickets, and we ended up buying, and we went down and watched the par 3 contest, and yeah, it was a cool trip. We did Pinehurst in there as well as a stopover, and yeah, it was a great time. Best Masters sandwich. I guess this one doesn't really apply to you too much if you've never been there, but, you know, would you throw something out there? Are you going to just throw pimento cheese at me?
Well, I can make like, you know, watching on TV cheese sure. sandwich, but it's more like a Kraft single grilled cheese. So any sandwich that you're having while watching the Masters is the best one for me.
Yeah, barbecue chicken was the one for me, and they're so cheap there. I mean, it's crazy. And, you know, you can spend $20 there and feed like three people, and I think that's one of the joys of the Masters. And pimento cheese, no thank you. Hmm. Not a fan. It's just basically, you know, hot mayonnaise as far as I'm concerned on white bread. It's not good.
That's a hot take. That is a hot take. We can move
I'm not the only one to say that before. Okay. It's really an acquired taste, that's all for right. sure. So. All right, this one's coming up a lot. This is actually a good one because, you know, a lot of people inside right now. Best golf movie, and this one's been passed around the internet a little bit in the last little while as well.
Yeah, shout out to Golf WRX. They're actually doing a poll right now, and they did a bracket for this. For me, it's
how do you even come up with a bracket? How do you even come up with enough movies, golf movies, to create a bracket?
Well, I mean, there are enough. You know, if you look at it from Happy Gilmore, Caddyshack, Tin Cup, The Legend of Bagger Vance. I can pull up the other four that clearly didn't really matter that much. But really, it's going to come down to, you know, those, the first three I gave you there. And for me, it is Caddyshack, though. I think it's hilarious. Tin Cup, close second. They're all great. But yeah, for me, Caddyshack's one that you can watch over and over.
I'm actually a big fan of The Greatest Game Ever Played, which, you know, you may not love that one, but it's got it's about Harry Vardon and the story of Francis we met at Brookline. Came out in 2005. Cool story. A lot of it was filmed at Kahnawake in Canada as well, and you should check that one out.
There you go.
All right, a couple more things on this list. Let's cut out a couple because there's just a lot that are here.
But, yeah, sure.
Golf ball, craziest golf related item. What is, I don't even know where to go with that.
Wow. So I'm trying to even think here. I don't think I have anything too crazy. I think the fact that I have like 12 pairs of shoes is crazy. the craziest item that I think I've seen, obviously both of us have worked in retail. The glove hand thing, and my buddy actually has one. It's kind of embarrassing. It's a plastic hand you put in your glove. So your
Out the gloves. I forgot about those things. So I probably sold a bunch of them back in the day.
That's the craziest and dumbest thing I've seen. Yeah. I don't own it for me. Yeah, I just think it's my 12. I just got a new pair of the new Nike Janowski G golf shoes. So this is a skateboard shoe that I've pretty much worn exclusively since I was like 17 years old, that they finally made into a golf shoe. That is a golf shoe, my 13th pair of golf shoes. So there's my answer, is the fact that I have 13 pairs.
I'm not even going to tell you how many pairs of shoes I have, but craziest golf, you know, that's a really... Yeah, that one's a tough one because, you know, every year you go to the PGA show and you see more things and more things and more things.
Do you have an alien wedge?
I never owned one. I definitely sold a few over the years. I would say one of the funniest things probably I won't say it's a crazy golf item, but kind of one of the weirdest ones that somebody thought they were going to make money on was basically one time I got run down in a parking lot at the PGA show with this German guy. Had this, it looked like two electrodes that you would attach to your head, and it was supposed to help your putting out. And literally this guy was like trying to pitch it at the show, and he saw I had a media badge on. And he thought he'd, you know, make his pitch and try. But, you know, there's no way I'm in a parking lot with this guy pulls up with this thing that looks like a battery and two electrodes and wants to attach it to my head and you know, go through a putting stroke to make it, you know, to improve my putting. And I was like, nah, I'll pass. I'm not seeing this going down in Orlando. I don't want to be heading to the hospital anytime soon. So, you know, golf is one of those sports that people always come up with the craziest things thinking they're going to improve your game. So, this category could be endless.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Last couple ones here. We'll go best major. Which one do you love?
Oh man, this is hard for me. It's like, I go back and forth between the Masters and the Open. I'm going to go with the open. If I have to pick one of the two, the reason is I like getting up early. It's something different. Once it's done, you go, then go golf. Mm-hmm. It's also, I think, like, I'm never going to be able to play Augusta National. I just know that. Like, if I could, I'll empty out whatever credit card's in my wallet at the time. You can max it out. I'll pay that much to play it. I get that. Where, you know, but even at that, like, I can get something somewhat similar, let's say. It's very North American golf. To get that Lynx, true Lynx style, that struggle, the rain, the wind, the changing conditions, you only get that in one place, right? And you know, that's somewhere in the United Kingdom or in Ireland. And I just think it's completely different from what we play. And it, you know, I think the best grinders, you know, they say the best grinders win the US Open. You can make an argument for the Open just from the weather conditions, and you know, any given week can change and at any point. So for me, it's the Open 100%.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. And I think it's the history of it too. And as you said, it's access. You think about most of the venues that host the Open, with the exception of a couple, but in most cases you can access them and you're able to go over and play that. And again, you know, early in the morning, I used to love the old BBC podcast. No podcast back then. Broadcast, you know, like 2-3 in the morning, they'd come on and CBC would cover it, and you'd be able to watch it. And then as soon as that's over, then yeah, you grab your clubs and go play 36 because you're inspired of watching it. And there's just so much to it. It's not that one dimensional, but you know, obviously the Masters really kicks off the spring, but you know, the Open is where it's at for me. All right. One last one here. Best locker room that you've ever come across.
So we actually had two, but I'm glad you skipped the one of favorite pro caddy, because that only gets both of us in a lot of trouble. Best locker room. I mentioned Superstition Mountain earlier. It's easily this one. This is the craziest locker room I've ever seen. You actually, there's an attendant at the door, and you had to put your cell phone in a basket before you got past this attendant. Whether there was business transactions happening back there, there was a poker game happening. There, you could buy a cigar from the attendant right there. What a cool locker room. There's books all over the wall. Very cool vibe. You could tell, like, gentlemen will spend hours in this locker room after a round of golf. And you know, what a cool place. I mean, I don't know how I'd ever get back to this locker room. I was very lucky to get in it in the first place, but easily the coolest locker room I've ever been in.
Yeah, there's some really neat ones that are out there. A modern one that comes to mind is Forest Creek in Pinehurst, but that's probably not my favorite, although it's spectacular. And, you know, you get many kinds of, you know, types of mints that you can get. And, you know, basically you just live in there. But the coolest one I think I've been in and I really appreciate is one at Atlantic City Country Club, where they've maintained the original lockers. And they've got lots of old newspaper clippings. And, you know, you've got these old style, we'll call it gangster era guys that, you know, they've got these photos and they keep their names on their lockers. So what happens is that, you know, the lockers sort of get passed down by, they keep the names of the original people that have had them on them. So this course goes back almost 100 or more than 100 years. And you've got basically the names of all the people that have been there on those lockers. And they, you know, they're beat up old, terrible looking lockers, but the room is just, you know, it's got this musty little smell to it, and it's just, there's just something about it that, you know, if they stripped that down and had renovated it over the years, it just wouldn't have the character that it does.
No, and I think that's what a lot of these other locker rooms try to build, is that, but you know, character comes with time. You can't force it. So that's really cool.
Yeah, 100%. So that's it for that. But we obviously have a few other questions left in the mailbag here. So let's kind of work through those. And I think one of these lends into what we were talking about a little bit when it came to our majors that we liked. But it may not. You never know. What style of golf course do each of you prefer, was the question that came in.
I assume they're thinking just kind of links versus...
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, parkland, heathland, moorland, whatever. Desert.
I mean, for me, it doesn't matter. Like, whatever was open, I just think like it's.
You're so picky.
Yeah, I'm really not. You know, I don't love playing in the rain. I enjoy playing in a lot of wind, though. I think that's fun. For me, it doesn't really matter. It just, you know, one that's in decent condition and you got a good crew. So I'm copping out on it. I don't have an answer for you. I don't care. I do love when I go to the desert and play golf. I'll tell you, I don't love playing Florida golf. You know, water isn't the most fun. Maybe that's because we're not great ball strikers. I don't know. but yeah, for me, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I love links style golf courses, but I like them for a particular reason. It's more the creativity of hitting the shot. So I like closely mown areas, but you know that style pervades. You know, it's into other areas as well. I mean, I played Southern Dunes when I was down in Florida this year, and you know they have a lot of chipping areas and places you can run the ball. So it's more just that style on the golf course that gives you options. So it's not all of a sudden forcing you to hit one shot. You can have lots of different choices. And it's up to you to execute it to get the best result out of it. All right. Suggestions on mats for indoor putting. This is a big one right now. There's a big surge, obviously, in buying. People are at home. You know, they don't always have the space to maybe have a hitting net in their garage or in their house or whatever, but everybody can pretty much putt. So any suggestions from your retail experience on a mat for indoor putting?
I don't care. I'm not helping you at all. Literally just grab one at the end of the day. Like, it's not like you're getting bent grass, Matt. It's just, it's glorified carpet. I hate to break it to you. Just grab one and just butt on it. Like the mat I have, I think is the cheapest one you can buy at a retail level. I'm sure there's like super high end ones. I just saw this Instagram ad the other day where it's like best putting mat for indoor putting or something. I was like, really? I doubt it. I really do doubt this is the best one considering we're selling it on Instagram. It doesn't matter to me. Just grab one. And if you don't want to spend the money, just grab a cup and just throw it at the end of the hall and just put on your carpet. You're really, whether the ball really goes in the hole or not doesn't matter that much when you're practicing indoors, you're putting. It's just the feel of actually putting more than anything.
Yeah, I happen to use one that's from a company called Wellputt, and I just like it just because the surface is fairly smooth, runs about 13 in one direction and 10 in the other direction. Doesn't have cups to it. It has marks all over it, and it comes with a little booklet of different games and targets and things that you can do. And, you know, the model I have, I think, sells for about $160. So you don't necessarily have to go that high end. But, you know, for me, it's more from a training perspective. I use it indoors with students and things like that. But for, as you said, for most people, anything is going to work. And really, you can get creative and do all sorts of things. And I'll mention that a little bit later in the tip of the week of things that you can do inside that are relative to that as well. But that Wellputt one's pretty good. Putout's got some. There's a lot of great ones out there, that's for sure. Just, you know what? Just get putting. Get something that you can use. If you don't like that one, don't spend too much money on it. Then, you know, if you don't like it, then pass it on to somebody else and upgrade to your next one.
Bingo.
All right. What is the difference between dynamic gold shafts and dynamic gold tour issue shafts? You want me to handle this one?
I have no idea. And I was a forfeiter of the year. So let's hear it.
Not a lot of big difference. The characteristics of the shaft are pretty much the same. They have the same sort of features as far as what they do for you. You know, it's a dynamic gold shaft, been around for a long time, fairly heavyweight shaft, fairly stiff. The biggest difference between these two is just the tour issue one has a higher tolerances. They have better tolerances. These are weight short sorted shafts, and basically the tolerances are plus or minus 2 grams in the standard one and plus or minus half a gram in the tour issue one. So you're talking about really picky stuff here. This is things that tour level players will pick up. So it's not, most players are not going to see the difference between those two, but that's really what it comes down to. I mean, it's not magic just because it has the word tour on it. It's not all of a sudden you're not going to hit the ball, you know, 20 yards further or anything like that. It's just a matter of tolerances in the way they sort the weight.
I'll TLDR that for you. The person that asked it, you're not going to notice a difference. What was the next question there, Scotty?
There you go. Somebody said, just starting to play golf and enjoy the podcast. That's great. Thank you. Why do golfers mark their balls beyond the number already on the ball? Well, you know what? That's you know, it seems like a simple question, but I guess if you're just starting out, it might not be something you think of. So why don't you take that one?
I mean, the main reason is so you can differentiate between your playing partners. A lot of times people play the same ball. When you're first starting out, it'll be a while before you probably want to play you know, that same ball, you know, we don't necessarily need to mention, it's pretty obvious, you know, who owns the ball market nowadays. But a lot of people mark them for, you know, whether it's superstition on top of that. Like if I'm going out and playing with you, it doesn't really matter whether we mark it or not. Maybe you're just superstitious and you always need to have your dot on this one spot, or you always need to have it say Scotty Mac on the side or something cool. I don't know what you mark your ball with or not.
Not that.
Yeah. Okay.
I used to, but once you lose them a few times and then people know that's your golf ball, yeah, you don't want to do that anymore.
Oh yeah, you say Big Daddy Scotty, right? I forgot. Yeah, for me, I never mark my ball unless I'm playing in a tournament. I don't care. So unless somebody's literally playing the exact same ball as me, and I don't have another one, then I'll mark it then. But other than that, I really don't care. It's literally just so if you have two beside each other, you know which one's which.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's, for me, it's probably because I'm lazy, so I don't have to, you know, look closer. I know what my mark is. I can walk up and I go, oh, that's my ball. I don't have to, you know, get down close and or pick it up to identify it or whatever the case may be. So yeah, that's Stefan's explained it there, and that's pretty much what it is.
Fun thing though. All right. I got a fun story about that. Sure. You ever played Yankee Swap, like a Christmas game where you all buy a gift and it's,
oh, yeah,
you know,
for
you
sure.
can trade yeah. and steal. So we had a big group of golfers in this Yankee Swap every single Christmas Eve, and I bought Pro V1s as my gift, and you can customize Pro V1s, and no one ever really opened them because for years and years, you know, you would get, you know, oh, Pro V1s, somebody else got a Pro V1, awesome, they just assume it is. But I customized these ones. Side of it, I put Stefan Tiedorf is my favorite golfer, and they didn't notice till they got to the first tee and realized they had 12 of Pro V1s with my name on the side of it as their That's favorite awesome. Golfer. So I'm sure somebody's found those somewhere out there. So those are fun. I like the little customizations on the side of them. So if you know, maybe it sounds like you're getting in golf, you enjoy the podcast, you just enjoy golf. Those are the fun things you can do with marking your golf ball.
Yeah, and you're right. I think that's some of the fun things in the game, that, you know, you just customize things and do stuff, you know, whatever way you want so that you can enjoy the game. So, you know, golf balls, obviously you can mark them a lot of different ways. You can get the customization and who knows, whatever you want to put on that ball, it could be something just as funny. All right, last question here. What's the longest golf course you have ever played?
I have no idea.
You even remember?
I don't really look. I mean, like, it's just like, hey, what tee do you guys want to play? And we'll go play that. I'm not one that believes you, like we've joked about it, you and I even. We've gone out and played, not even played the tips. And I think the one time we went out and played last year was 6,200 yards. And,
sure,
you know, we're fine. And I think the joke you always say is, hey, if we're making too many birdies, we'll move back. I think the one round you guys tipped out the Flagstick Open and around 7,100. Sure, why not? Yep. But, like, I don't need to play a long golf course. I don't really care. So I don't know the answer. Whatever. Well, who knows? Whatever the Flagstick Open was at one point or another.
That's kind of cool, actually, that you haven't really looked at that. I mean, I have to look at it sometimes if I'm writing stories and you're away on a travel trip or something like that, and you might not necessarily be playing back there, but sometimes it, you know, it's something that you get obligated to write about because people are always ask how, you know, how far is it, even though they're not going to go back there. The ocean course at Kiwa Island, when the back tees were 7804. And I played the back there, and we mentioned our friend Rich, who came on and guest hosted with you. We played it the one time where he had broken his driver and he had to play 3-wood, and we were determined to play off the back tees just for fun because we knew we were going to shoot a million. And we had to get permission. The pro had to come down, see us hit balls off the tee, and then, you know, allow us to go out and play those tees. And they eventually created some longer ones because they were going to host the PGA Championship as an option. They never play it. Like, the tournaments there, the most they've ever played it, I think, was the PGA Championship. They played like 7,400. And even when they had the World Cup, they played it under 7,000 because the wind was up. So what they tried to do there is they tried to make tees in case winds come from a different direction. So that they can move, you know, the course and be a little bit more versatile. And I know they went back to 8150 that was available that they could use, but you certainly, they would never set up the course at that yardage. Just those tees are available in case all of a sudden you get a big north wind or a big south wind, and they can make, you know, certain holes longer, certain holes shorter based on the wind.
You know what that is? You know the guys that buy a truck? And then they like,
yeah, exactly.
They lift them really high.
Yeah.
Well, what are you doing with that? That needs to be lifted that high. That's what the golf course, that's the golf course equivalent of that.
Well, you know, they ended up at 8150, they ended up with 7 par fours over 500 yards. So that's not going to be a lot of fun.
No.
I don't know about you, but I don't want to be hitting long irons into every shot or hybrids into every green. I mean, so it's an option, but certainly even the pros are not going to play it back there. Although it may be available in most cases, most of the golf courses that have yardage like that, it's more for a brag. It's more for marketing and has really nothing to do with playability or how the golf course plays.
Yeah, 100%.
All right, that's the mailbag this week. Really enjoyed that. Keep those questions coming. We certainly appreciate it. We know a lot of people are at home, maybe got a little bit extra time. So if you want to come up with some more questions for us, we're always willing to address them.
I appreciate them. All right. Well, you said we're going to be all at home. I assume you're going to give us some indoor tips for the tip of the week this week.
Yeah, we're going to stick with the indoor theme because obviously we're not outside. But one thing that I'm trying to tell a lot of people to do, especially students and things like that, is just keep a club in your hand. That's really what it amounts to. It's a familiarity thing as far as from a touch perspective. But that doesn't mean you necessarily have to be grinding away and doing all sorts of different drills or things like that. You can have fun too. So one of the things that I've done, I set up for my daughter, is that we're going to play a little mini golf around the house with ping pong balls. And we're going to chip. Working around, we were playing around with it earlier tonight, and we just set up some solo cups. We're chipping into them, trying some little trick shots, stuff like that. It's just having a club in your hand that's more important than anything, as opposed to just always developing, you know, certain skills. Just because you have a club in your hand, you're familiar with it, you have that feel, it's not going to feel as foreign when you get back outside and you haven't had a club in your hand in a while. So have fun with it. Be creative, try some things indoors, lots of fun challenges. Like I said, ping pong balls are fun so that you don't break anything in the house. Fun for chipping around, curving the ball, all sorts of things. Kids love them too, and adults do too. So just keep a club in your hand, have some fun, and you'll get more out of it. And you know what? When we get back to the golf course again, you'll be better for it.
I love it. I'm going to get back doing that. I've been avoiding the clubs out of sadness, I think. I just haven't been showing them any yeah. love. So I'm going to go grab the wedge, start chipping around some ping pong balls, that's for sure. All right, that's it for this week. As I said, next week we got some great ideas as well. You know, the Ryder Cup is one that I've kind of approached you with. I think we're going to do a little bit of a draft next week. So a little hint at that. Watch it. We're going to talk some Ryder Cup next week. We're going to break down another Masters, maybe a U.S. Open, maybe an Open. Who knows? You know, whatever we can find, we're going to break it down. So if you have a certain tournament you want us to watch and chat about next week, we'll do that. But other than that, we really don't know. We're playing it out day by day, just like everybody else. And all we know is the podcast will continue. We're going to try to have some more and more fun and try to bring some positive into your ears every single week. And that's all we can really commit to at this point. Is that fair to say, Scotty?
100%. And, you know, we're fortunate. We've got a great golf community. We've got some great people, just like Brennan, you know, this week, that are willing to give us their time and to come on and tell us some stories and tell us about their experience in golf. So we hope to continue more of those and, you know, just keep people connected to the game. And it's a sport that we all love. And, you know, this is why we talk about it every week. And we're just going to keep doing that. And eventually, you know, we'll get back out and we'll get to play some as well.
I love it. We'll be back. Well, we will be back outside. It's going to take a bit. Just do what you got to do. Stay inside, you know, we want to be outside too. Please just stay inside till they say it's okay to go out there. And, you know, we're taking care of ourselves so we can take care of each other. And that's, you know, it's hard to do. You know, there's worse things that could have happened, but all they're asking right now is stay inside. We can do that. And if we need to bring you more content to keep you inside, we will do that. Just tell us what you want to hear from us and we'll get back to you. But until next week, we are all done this week's episode of the podcast. Thank you everyone for listening. Make sure you subscribe, like, share it with all your friends, and we will chat with you next week.
just the motion of the day, like the day my boat's lost in the ocean.